I was very surprised when I read Ragnarok, and even when I heard about the book project, because your writing usually is about psychology, about details, textures, colors, descriptions of works of art or crafts. It seems to be very remote from your usual subjects of interest, the notion of myth. So how did you come to write about that?
The publisher, in fact, Canongate, has commissioned a series of writings of myth from various writers internationally and in Britain. And they said to me, would I like to write a myth? And I said, this is my myth, the death of the gods. And I have been slightly worried because some of the myths that have been written seem to regard it as their business to modernize the story and take out, as it were, the theological elements and make it human. And that's what I think exactly you ought not to do. A myth is not human. A myth is a different kind of story. I think most of my novels have a mythical layer. There's a kind of series of mythical images running under the natural ones and under the real world ones. I keep forgetting my novels these days, but and some of my short stories are very much attached to, sorry. Some of my short stories are attached to the world of mythology and fairy tales. I'm not a religious creature, but anyone looking at human beings sees that myth has been part of human life since the beginning. And there's a very great scientist, E.O. Wilson, who studies ants. And he has a wonderful page where he has a series of things that are in all human societies, things that are in all ant societies. I think he can't possibly know whether ants have myths or not, but he says all human societies have a myth. And I've thought about this myth. It sort of haunts all my writing and thinking ever since I was a very small child, like the child in the book.
And do you think there is such a thing as a British mythology? And I read the book, and especially the chapter about Yggdrasil, it made me think of that old English poem, The Dream of the Rood, in which you have a comparison between the cross and a tree, which is very reminiscent of Yggdrasil.
Part of my problem, just historically, is that I went to Cambridge and not Oxford, so I didn't have to do Anglo-Saxon. And I didn't. So my background tends to go towards, I in fact did Italian, so I read Dante. And my interest in Norse mythology is very much my own. And I never studied The Dream of the Rood, but you're absolutely right. I think the English are not very good at mythology. Just as I think the French don't seem to have a lot of indigenous fairy tales. The English have fairy tales. And the last Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, wrote a book about Welsh mythology. I've talked to him from time to time about mythology, and he's sort of passionately interested in it. And I think the Welsh have much more mythology than the English, who are rather down to earth. We have sort of nasty beasts and witch women and traps for unwary children. And I haven't thought about this for a long time, but there's a terrible thing called yallery brown, which means yellowish brown, which lives in a hole in Lincolnshire. And if you get anywhere near it, it sucks you in, you're finished. And that's a kind of English myth. It's not a grand myth of the gods going out to die on the plain. It's a rather nasty creature behind a stone that will get you if you're so stupid as to go near it. And there were a lot of 19th century books written called fairy mythology. I forget the authors, but there was an attempt in the 19th century when everybody was interested in myths to collect English fairy tales and turn them into an English mythology. Whereas I think there is a profound difference between a myth and a fairy tale. And I know there's a difference, and I find it very hard to define. I find myself talking to people about it. Mm-hmm. And I say, well, that's obviously a fairy tale. And the sort of Norse gods are obviously a myth. And I think, again, a lot of modern children have studied all of them in a kind of tumble together. They don't make the separation I automatically make. And I think a myth, I thought as a girl, is something that attempts to explain the universe, mm-hmm. or to personify the universe, to personify the nature of things. Whereas a fairy tale is a story you tell in the dark, round the fire, to amuse yourself or frighten yourself or comfort yourself. And I really do not know why we so need stories that are not true. I have to go back to England and talk to Terry Pratchett about why do we need fantasy. Do you know Terry Pratchett?
Yes.
Yes. I mean, Terry Pratchett is one of my complete heroes. I think he understands myths and fairy tales and modern life and the nature of narrative and the nature of language. I can say it in France. I think his use of the English language is about 100 times as good as J.K. Rowling. He's so witty and clever, and you think you've understood something and you read it another 2 years later, and actually there's another two or three layers to it. He's very clever. But I don't know why we need fantasy. I hope you will tell me. I've been reading a lot of Freud. Mm-hmm. In fact, this is interesting. I've been reading Freud because the next novel is about surrealism and psychoanalysis. And Freud realized how important it was that when we were dreaming, untrue things happened. And untrue beasts were created by joining one thing to another. And animals spoke. And he started analyzing it in terms of human sexuality. And there was another psychoanalyst called Carl Abraham in Berlin who wrote a little book I've just been reading about dreams and myths. And he does a very subtle analysis of the various different countries' use of the myth of the sun and the earth and the creation of fire. Mm-hmm. And he sort of connects this to Adam and Eve and various other Ur stories of the nature of things. And I've just finished that, or perhaps I have a page to go. But he does it very carefully. And again, he says it is all to do with human sexuality, but he doesn't reduce it simply to the sexual. He sort of talks about the nature of men and the nature of women. Mm-hmm. I've just received an email from my student granddaughter, and she wants me to immediately send examples of women and madness because she has to write. She has to, which fits on to thinking about Freud and men and women.
So would you consider this as a myth, women and madness in literature, for example?
Well, the one that came in, I'm so tired of Jane Eyre. Mm-hmm. So is she. She refuses to read it again. But the one that came into my mind was Cassandra, mm-hmm. Who was my other favourite figure beside the Norse gods when I was a girl. The idea of her knowing everything and refusing to be a sexual being and therefore nobody believing anything she said, so she was mad. I think that's a very interesting example of madness. And she comes into Shakespeare in Troilus and Cressida and tells everybody exactly what will happen and nobody believes her. And I wept for her when I was a little girl. I felt it was an image of me, this person who knew what was going on and nobody believed a word of it. And you have to compromise yourself with the world in order that people believe you. And had she allowed Apollo to rape her, mm-hmm. he would have allowed her to know the truth and be believed. But she didn't want that. And I liked her independence when I was about 12 or so, I thought. This is an interesting person. And there's the one in Aeschylus and there's the one in Shakespeare. Mm.
It's very difficult, isn't it, to draw a line between characters of fiction and myth, in that case, for example. But you write in the book that a mythological figure is supposed to have one feature, whereas a character of fiction is supposed to have psychology.
Yes, Cassandra is very interesting because she's in between those mm-hmm. two. I mean, in a sense, she only has two features. She knows the truth and speaks it and goes mad. That's one. And she refuses sex with the god of the sun and poetry, and that's another. And Apollo really only has two or three features. He's very strong. He's the god of poetry. He's the god of light. And he's quite cruel. You can't do the psychology of Apollo. Whereas you can a little bit do the psychology of human characters who get into myths. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can do the psychology of Oedipus, because Oedipus is human. But you can't do the psychology of Zeus, because he's a myth. And I think the reason I love Aeschylus more than Euripides is that Aeschylus's tragedies are mythical. Mm-hmm. They have the form of myths even while the human beings are caught in them. And Euripides is already doing psychology. He's interested in why people do things. And this is also very beautiful, but they're not so strange.
What about Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress? You have a lot of allusions to the book in Ragnarok. And you have that distinction between those characters that come straight out of a morality plate, which are quite empty shells, basically, and Christian himself, who has more psychology, right? And you seem to put it on the side of myths rather than fiction.
I remember a lot of the things I write about in Ragnarok, I did read first at the age of the little girl mm-hmm. who was reading them as I did on the landing and rushing back into her bedroom if her mother comes up the stairs. And I did alternately read Pilgrim's Progress and this book about the gods, the Norse gods. And I remember puzzling about similarities and differences with Pilgrim's Progress. And at some point I thought Bunyan has such a strong imagination that he started to write an allegory and ended by putting several people in who could almost have been in a novel. Mm. And when I was a postgraduate student, I started writing a thesis on 17th century religious allegory, which would have included Bunyan, because I am sort of technically as a writer interested in the way human narrative moved from the characters embodying meaning to the point where the writer was looking at the character's psychology, which is not a word Bunyan would have used or known anything about, but he liked Christian. He described Christian's feelings and Christian's wife and his children a little bit, and hopeful is very moving. But what I wanted to do with the thesis I never wrote was reach the point where allegory is left behind and something else happens, which I think would actually have been Paradise Lost. Mm-hmm. And Milton writes the ancient Old Testament myth, but he gives character to everybody. Mm-hmm. Character to God, character to Satan, character to Adam and Eve. And that, in a way, I came to see as the first novel. And then he wrote, do you know Paradise Regained?
No,
Paradise Regained, almost nobody knows it. It is one of the most beautiful poems I've ever read. Mm-hmm. And it goes back towards the allegorical, although it was written. It's the story of the temptation of Christ in the desert mm-hmm. by Satan. And it's very, very tightly written. And Satan is throwing all these delicious temptations at Christ. It's sort of a garden, you know, a sort of dangerous garden of beautiful things, and Christ just says no. And then this wonderful last line, and you know, Christ is up on the roof and the devil puts him up there and says, you know, if you are really God, throw yourself down. And the last line is English monosyllables, and it's a perfect iambic pentameter, and it goes, tempt not the Lord thy God, he said, and stood. That sends shivers down my spine. But it, in a funny way, it's wonderful that Milton went back to an earlier way of looking at human beings, because Milton's Christ is not human in Paradise Regained, mm-hmm. in the way in which Adam and Eve, and Satan above all. And Satan, in a sense, is like Christian. Somebody's human imagination has rushed out of the bounds they tried to put it in. And I read something a few weeks ago by Walter Benjamin, who wrote his thesis on, I think it was German 18th century allegory. It was possibly 17th century. I bought it, but I can't read it. And Benjamin's theory was that allegory was written for a closed aristocratic society, which had very precisely defined virtues and vices. And there was no way of describing a human being except in terms of these abstract qualities, which didn't belong to anybody but the rich. Mm-hmm. And Benjamin was a Marxist, but he has a point. And of course, Bunyan was the beginning of the common people writing about psychology. I'm saying all sorts of things I've been thinking the last few weeks that no, you might want to know. But it's something I've thought about. I mean, it's the centre of my writing all my life, really. What is writing about the meaning and what is writing about the people? Mm-hmm. And where do they coincide? And so writing Ragnarok was a sort of huge excitement for me, because I went right back to the mythological excitements of my childhood. And rather as tempt not the Lord thy God, he said and stood, is a perfect moment. So is the perfect moment at the end of Asgard and the Gods, when all the gods are dead, and there is nothing left except a black sea that stretches forever with a few gold chessmen floating in it. And the German who wrote Asgard and the Gods says he believes that the original myth stopped there. Mm-hmm. The original Norse myth, and that later people came along who were Christian, and they thought, oh no, we can't have that. It has to be a Christian resurrection. So they said, after a very long time, the world was remade and the gods came together and danced under the trees again, and you know, it was all good. And the child I was really angry with this. And the woman I am is still very angry, because it's about the only text I know where it goes towards a bad end, and a bad end is reached. And that's that. And the gods are killed. And the only other thing I can think of, there must be others, is King Lear. Mm. I mean, at the end of King Lear, it looks as though Cordelia can be saved. It looks as though King Lear can be rescued and looked after in his old age.
Yes. Well, I think she was saved in some forced restoration.
Yes, they couldn't bear it. They kept rewriting it and saving her. There's another person they saved. I don't think it was Desdemona.
I think Romeo and Juliet were saved at some point.
Yes. It's very wrong to save people when people have destroyed them. And I knew very young, just like the girl in the book, who is myself. The girl in the book knows that things can end badly. Will end badly, in fact. I mean, everybody will die. It's not good. You have good bits in between birth and death. And in fact, it gives you strength to have an image of things not ending right. Mm-hmm. It's quite important to know, which is why I have trouble with the resurrection. I feel it's cheating me, you know. The passion on the cross is terrible and awful. And I've noticed in England at the moment, there are a large number of, a number anyway, of novels and texts about the life of Jesus, very carefully saying he was a human who died. But they seem to need at this moment to write that novel. There's a young lady, a young novelist called Naomi Alderman, who grew up as an Orthodox Jew. I haven't read the novel yet, but I've bought it, and apparently it sort of balances the Christian story against the story of the Jew who preached and was killed. And Colm Toy Bean recently did it also, from the Irish perspective of mm-hmm. this religion is not true, but the story is moving. It's quite interesting, and there are several others I've read reviews of. But I have such problems with Christianity that I have to make myself start to read them, really.
I thought there's this vision of Christ as a sort of mythical hero on the point of view of the girl came from the early English text, again, the early English literature in which Christ is seen as a hero, probably derived or related to the Anglo-Saxon or the Norse mythology, but you'd say it rather comes from Milton, your point.
It could come from Milton, yes. In my case, it would come from Milton, because Milton I know and the Anglo-Saxon I don't know. But it is true that the Anglo-Saxons wrote about heroism. And in a way, they would have been more comfortable with Christ than Milton, who was a Puritan and is writing about someone who stuck to his principles, rather than someone who saved the world by being the best. Mm-hmm.